Punk's not dead, and neither is New Wave. Join Buzz and Ben on Static Rage, the Punk and New Wave Album Review Podcast.
It's that time of year again, Buzz.
It is indeed that time of year. And as everyone knows, when they listen to this podcast, we do something during March and October specifically. And that time has once again come for our March episodes.
That it has. You know, life is what life is. And I'm sure that many of our listeners out there are feeling the effects of it too. But, you know, these are two very special times of year for us. So here we are.
And as always, we will always try to do, as long as we can both do it, do shows during March and October. If we get time to do it again during the year, we definitely will. But right now, we always at least do these two. So tonight, we're going to kick things off with the only American punk band that we're going to talk about this month. Well, that's not technically true, but all the members are American. We'll put it that way.
Yeah. Which is the Dropkick Murphys and their second studio album, The Gang's All Here, released on March 9th of 1999. Had a runtime of 42 minutes and 51 seconds. It was released on Hellcat Records. And it was produced by Lars Frederiksen, whom I add parenthetically, I'm a big fan of. The personnel: Al Barr on vocals, Rick Barton on guitar, Ken Casey on bass guitars and vocals, Matt Kelly on drums, John Delaney on the bagpipes on Amazing Grace, Johnny Cunningham on fiddle on Will Misfortune and The Gang's All Here, Torek Ard pipe and drum corps on drums on Roll Call, Jim Siegel engineer, Thomas T.J. Johnson engineer on Roll Call, and Marco Almera did the cover, which is actually pretty fucking cool.
So before we jump into this, I actually kind of want to talk about the album because I have the physical copy, and this is one of the few physical copies that I've kept through the years. People that listened to last time when we covered Dropkick, when we did Do or Die, I mentioned that album art sometimes plays a big deal. And when you go to purchase CDs and things back in the 80s and 90s, early 2000s. And this one's actually no different. For those that may have not seen this, and we'll have a thumbnail up on the our podcast and all. It is four prominent, but there's more people in the background. There's four prominent on the cover, carrying M1 Garands, clearly they're American GIs during World War II. I've heard also it could be argued that it might be during Korea, but I think World War II makes more sense.
I would agree with that.
And then the artists,
just with the planes overhead and everything.
Oh yeah, yeah. The artists actually, interestingly, put his name on one of the lower rifles for the gentleman in the back. So it's kind of a cool little pickup. It's like, hey, Almera's name is right there. But yeah, it flat out looks like if it wasn't for the planes, I'd say it'd be like maybe the storming of Omaha Beach. But there's planes, and if you know your history, there were no planes at that landing just yet. When you open it up, there is a, I don't know whose family it was. I think it might have been Al Barr's grandfather. I could be wrong on this, so if someone can correct me, please do. When you open the bad boy up, it's OD green, it's military green, and it's a, I'm assuming it's Army. It doesn't look like Marine uniforms, but it's a Army basic training class that's just completed basic training, and they're all posing with their M1s. So it's kind of fucking cool. And of course, in the back, you have there's band playing live. I go over this for a reason, because this is one of the few bands where usually the album artwork corresponds to what the album is going to be like. So if you can understand everything I just said, that should set the tone for the album that we're going to talk about tonight.
Yeah, I think it does. This is, I don't want to say that it's completely different than like any of the other Celtic punk stuff that we've done in the past, but it is in a different context, because it's really not talking about, I mean, there's a few stuff. They definitely point towards their Irish roots and stuff on here, but it's not as baked in as it usually is in these types. And this is much more American than Irish American.
When we talked about the first album that we did from Dropkick Murphys, I had mentioned that the plastic patty thing comes into saying a lot of people use it as a derogatory term for people that pretend to be Irish. This band has always kind of never shied away from the fact that they all have Irish ancestry, but they're not from Ireland, and they've always kind of pointed that out. And that's why I appreciate that even though when they do certain songs that kind of hint at that heritage, it's like, hey, we're still an American band. We're not trying to be something we're not, but this is, hey, our parents, grandparents, great grandparents, et cetera, we have a clear lineage going back to this, and this is what we're proud of. The thing I wanted to bring up with the album artwork as we go down the songs tonight, even though they're not blatantly about warfare, they kind of all have a militaristic theme to them, while correlating to everyday life and historical events. So it really is kind of cool that they incorporated that into this album. Before we get too far down, for again, if those either have not heard the first album or have not heard the last time we did an episode on this band, Mike McLaughlin is no McColgan, excuse me, is no longer on this album. He did leave after the first one to go be a firefighter. They replaced him with Al Barr. Ken Casey was still playing bass. This is going to be essentially the same lineup from here on out through current era. I think they might have changed one or two other people around, but Al Barr and King Casey have always gone back and forth on vocals, and that's something that we'll talk about tonight more than likely.
Yeah, I imagine we will. And to your earlier point about how the band identifies and what they represent, of course, being from this area, because there's a lot of Irish imagery in and around Boston for obvious reasons, but this is one of those bands that I often more associate with Boston Irish identity than Irish Ireland identity.
And I think that's actually important. It's much like how there was a time when the Italian American identity was a huge deal, for good reason. And so this kind of mixes in with that. You really do get to see a lot of it. You get to see it almost like a subculture in and of itself. It's also interesting too, before we get too far off the beaten path, there's plenty of video. Boston neighborhoods play people playing like stickball, for example, and you're seeing graffiti on walls of buildings and park benches, et cetera, of what you might see in Northern Ireland. Like I remember watching a video a couple years ago that was recorded during, I want to say it was like 92 or 93, and it was about Marky Mark, if you guys want to remember how young he was back then. And he's playing fucking stickball with some of these people, and there's all this like Brits out now, and there was the hunger strikers that were on a fucking mural, and I'm like, oh, this is actually kind of cool. I mean, it's interesting and weird in a way, but it's still kind of cool. So for those who have never been to that area, there's a lot of that going on. There's a lot of connection to, for lack of a better word, like a motherland for certain people. And you see that. And of course, this band does play that out. But I've always enjoyed the fact that they do it, but they're not as blatantly in your face about it. It's more of a, hey, it's kind of subtle until it's not. And even when it's not subtle, it's not like shoving your face. It's more of like, hey, we're going to incorporate this instrument to make it sound like this, but it's still clearly our own thing. So I've always had props to this band for that reason.
Well, in Boston and Philadelphia, they kind of fight over the being the birthplace of America and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a lot of that there too. So there's a bunch of layers. I mean, it's been a few years since I've been to Boston, and when I went to Boston, I wasn't in any of the neighborhoods that would have had the graffiti if it's still up, which it might not be. But like there is like a revolutionary era stuff everywhere. Because that's where the shit went down. So it's to be expected.
Indeed. And there's actually down here in Tennessee, we actually have a town called Erin, and damn near everyone that lives there, if you are a Caucasian, you're probably Irish. Like that, just if I'm gonna throw it out there, it's like going into like little Ireland out in the country. That is exactly what that town is like. Without going into too much detail, there's little parts in the south that do have little pockets, so to speak, but it's nowhere near as dense as you find in Boston, Philadelphia, and even parts of New York.
For sure. But not, with that out of the way, let's talk about the album.
So with that in mind, cool thing about this album is it's a lot more, I think, fast-paced than the previous album, and I think that's a good thing. There are parts where it does slow down, but I do feel like it's much more aggressive in its playing, which is interesting because usually bands start slowing down after the first album. This time they kicked it up a notch. And part of me wonders if that's the second vocalist they brought in. And the other thing about this is going with pacing is the longest song on here is only about 3.5, is only right under 4 minutes. It really is. So this album gets in and out. It's you can listen to the whole thing during a workout session. I mean, that's kind of what's cool about it. Say for like if you're taking like the hidden track at the end, if you take that out of it, it's really closer to like almost a 30-minute album. So it does get in and out. So those of you that want to listen to it, if you want to get it like an idea of what we're talking about tonight, it's not a very long album. You'll be able to get in and out pretty quickly. Was this your first time listening to this, Ben?
Yeah, as of that entire album, it was. I've heard some of the tracks off of it, of course, but I had never listened to the entire album.
Sure. So when I first heard this album, this came out my freshman year. I was still, I mean, I knew who they were by this time, but I didn't get a chance to get my hands on a physical copy until after we came back from my sophomore year. But I do remember it coming out. I remember people making a big deal about it. And I heard some of the songs off there, and then when I came back to school, I had a buddy that made me a CD, and I got to listen to it for a while. So, yeah, everything is awesome, man. It starts out with with drums and pipe in the background, and it's a very simple 30-second intro, and it sets the stage. I mean, it's rallied. Was it rallied together around the sin of battle is near this the cannon sounds, new year begins, fear nothing now, the gang's all here. And then it goes straight into the first song, like just directly picks up and it just smacks you in the face. So that is the pacing of this album.
Yeah, it is pretty swift. I mean, I do think that it as an album, you're right, you can do it in one workout. It's a little on the long side, but the tracks themselves are not. There's a good track economy in that, as you stated, there are very few tracks that are over 3 minutes, and only two that are over 3 minutes and 50 seconds long. So there's a lot of meat on this bone with the 16 tracks that are on it.
This is an album when you start listening to it. If you kind of know what to expect going in, you will, I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. This is not something that if you are into this kind of music that you'll be disappointed with. There could be an argument to be made that there are better albums out there. There's also an argument to be made that there's much worse albums out there. Like with just about every other punk band we'll talk about, you have to be into this kind of music. If you're not, then you're not going to enjoy it. That said, there are a few songs on here that I could go, hey, you know what? I could slow this down even more, and it might not be a punk song. It might be a pop song. It might be like a generic rock song. And that kind of does something the first album couldn't, to where you can almost reach a wider audience. At least that's what it felt like to me.
I would agree with that. I think that there's some stuff that I don't necessarily know that it'd go pop. I mean, there probably are a couple of tracks if I really went back and went through them all in my head. But there are also some, especially more some of the more traditional stuff, that if they slowed them down and, played them with acoustic instruments or whatever, it would be folk, more traditional music. So yeah, there is that. And I do think that not that I'm super familiar with the Dropkick Murphys discography, but this one is much more straight ahead American punk than I think a lot of their other stuff is.
It
At
is.
least the singles and stuff that I've heard.
It is. When we talked about Do or Die, there wasn't a lot of blatantly in your face, like, hey, we're an Irish ancestry. There was a couple things on there, but it was much like this. It felt a little bit different. It felt more like it felt more the first one felt more like an underground punk band. You could tell this is more of a, hey, we're out there, people know who we are, but we're still not popular. And we're still bringing you the same great punk sound that you knew before, without being too, that's what I'm looking for, without being too polished. The next album and the ones that come to follow are, depending on who you talk to, are good. But they don't quite have the same level the first two do. And the first two are almost not completely different, but the vocalists and the pacing of how fast the songs are moving does make it almost like an experience rather than something you would listen to. And I hate using that word for punk because that's, to me, that's not what it is. But you could argue that point, that it could be more of an experience rather than just, hey, this is a cool album. And that's something that will hit just about every song down here. The playing is on point. This sounds like a band again, that they practice, they know what they're doing. Everything sounds just like it doesn't sound overproduced, which is important to me. It sounds like it's just got the correct amount of production without being too over the top or too out there for people that wouldn't like this kind of music to listen to. And
Yeah, it sounds like it was recorded in a studio, but it doesn't sound like it spent a whole lot of time in the studio. And you might reject this, I don't know, but it also seems, I mean, and this is only their second album, but it doesn't seem like they've formed their identity of what the Dropkick Murphys are going to be.
no, I think you're correct. I would actually accept that instead of reject it. I think a lot has to do with Mike leaving the band, because Mike really was the driving force for the first album. It really was. The first album was very much like a working man's punk, and this kind of does hit that as well. But it's almost like it switched from working man's punk more to what I would call like bar punk. Or I know it's not really a subgenre, but it's less about what you would consider like street punk or even definitely not crust punk.
Oh yeah,
But
I'm far
it
away from that.
definitely fits into that. Hey, this is almost like its own little subgenre that doesn't really exist yet. There are a few songs on here as we go down that do harken back to like a working man's type thing, but for the most part, it's about everyday life.
Yeah, there
And
are a few. I mean, I'd almost say that like this is almost GI punk, and not just because of the album art, but I mean like a lot of these songs, as you stated, have might not be exactly about war, but they do have military overtones.
sure. And I mean, I haven't mentioned like in the opening, that's exactly why I wanted to talk about the album art. And then when you start looking down at some of the tracks, I mean, they're pretty blatantly about some kind of combat without it being about warfare. And it's almost like they're using euphemism of, in this case, I would say World War II, or even up to what happened in Somalia in 93.
Yeah. There's
In
a little
that
bit of
era,
civil war in here too,
it is a little
but
civil
yeah.
war. There's an argument to be made on one of the tracks when we get to them, that, and I've not seen it because it's not blatant, and maybe I'm just not hearing it. Someone mentioned that one of the tracks might have a line that kind of takes a dig at the 1916 Easter Rising. I don't know. The first time I heard that was a couple of days ago. I'm not gonna get too far into that because I don't know which line of that song they were talking about, but I'm like, I'm not seeing it, but okay.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I nothing springs to mind, but like I don't have all the lyrics printed out in front of
Yeah,
me either.
I don't. I mean, when we get to it, I'll mention it, but I don't know the line that they were talking about, so I'll just be like, okay, well, something in here just reminded them of that, and there you go.
But like you said, I mean, this is I like Albar's vocals. It kind of makes me want to go back and listen to the Bruisers just to see what he sounded like there. But there's nothing to complain. If you're into this genre of music, whether we're talking about Celtic punk or just regular punk, the playing on here is going to be what you expect, and I can't imagine that you're going to find anything wrong with it.
Yeah, this is it's kind of everything I want out of a punk band. Like, it really is. And I know it seems like a long shot to say it like that, but it really just it everything fits so well. The thing about Albarr replacing Mike, I've almost equated him not quite to the singer of the Cro-Mags, but very like he's got the same head, almost the same presence to where he's on stage, he has like almost a more aggressive presence than what he is as a person. And I definitely think that helps out their live shows a lot. But this is about the time that he and Kimbo start wearing flat tops a lot more, and this is kind of where that identity started. And it's why, as of right now, if you go see my live shows, Al Ken and I think Matt Kelly wears one on stage. I don't know. I'm not entirely sure. I can't. It's been a while since I've been to one of their live shows, but I know for sure Ken and Al will wear them when they come on stage all the time. And when Mike was in the band, he'd never did that. So it was kind of interesting to. It doesn't seem like it's a big deal, but it does help with the physical identity later on as you see them.
Now, do you know, because I know that Al had to take a break because of family medical stuff back in 22, and I don't know, I didn't know if he was back with the band or not.
As I understand, he didn't make the 22 tour. He's officially not rejoined with them yet. In case he kind of took over. I know during COVID, they did a free St. Patrick's Day set. And I remember, I don't remember if Al was there or not. I really don't. I know Ken was. Ken was doing a lot of the vocal stuff on his own. But Al is not, he's not kicked out. He's not fired. He hasn't quit. He's just dealing with personal issues. And I mean, we all know how that goes. So
Yeah, no, totally.
it's one of those, is my understanding is, hey, whenever you want to come back, we're ready for you, but we're going to go ahead and release another two or three albums if you don't mind. And that's my understanding of what's going on right now. I imagine it'd be the same thing if Mike ever wanted to come back, they'd probably tell him the same thing. Hey, you want to rejoin? Cool. Yeah. Come on back and we'll do some old stuff at the live shows and try to write some new things as well. But yeah, that's kind of where that comes from. But yeah, both of them do a pretty good job. And what's cool is they go back and forth. Having two vocalists in a band, even though Ken is not the primary vocalist, you can tell when he comes in. He's got the cleaner of the two voices, and it's interesting because this is about the time bands like Mushroomhead start getting bigger. And if you've ever listened to Mushroomhead, they have like two vocalists at any given time. And it's interesting that for some reason, this time period is just having a lot of people in a band and having two people do kind of the same thing, but having different tones to it makes the sound interesting. So I'm sure that was not done on purpose, but it's just kind of amusing that this time period is when this happens. But I think. Is there anything else you want to talk about production-wise before we move on
No, man,
to?
I'm ready to go
Okay.
to tracks if when you are.
All right. Well, as of always, since this is your first time listening to it, I'd like you to go first so I can get your thoughts on it as well. So I'll let you kick it off.
So I think that this again, with the length of this album and as short as the tracks are, I really think you should just crawl into it if you're into this because you'll probably like most of it. For myself, I thought the things that stood out were the first five tracks: Roll Call, Blood and Whiskey, Pipeballing on Lansdowne, Perfect Stranger, and 10 Years of Service. Then I like Devil's Brigade, Homeward Bound, The Fighting 69th, Boston Asphalt. Love the Amazing Grace instrumental. The Gang Talk here. I see what they were doing, but I do think it's a bit long, and it suffers from a thing that was kind of the bane of a lot of 90s album, the hidden track phenomenon, where they just decide to play the dude's fucking answering machine, which at the time I was super into, but now, 20 something years later, I'm not as into.
Yeah, so I'm gonna mimic everything Ben just said. The ones that stick out the most to me are Blood and Whiskey. That is the one that someone tried telling me has a dig at the 1916 Easter Rising. Here's why I take issue with that. It sounds to me like it's more about because the primary chorus is Shake the Hand That Shook the World. I th think they're going back to their Irish roots with this because that's really what it sounds like. so I can maybe see why they think that, but there's nothing that blatantly fucking says that anything in this song that has to do with it. It sounds more like, hey, these people came here, they came with blood, they came with whiskey, and with their own fists, they kind of brought up the world, i.e. they helped build America. That's kind of what this song is about to me. It's about, hey, we came from this, we had to fight to get here, and be proud of who you are, what you are, regardless of your background, and this is our story of how our people shaped America, and you're gonna have something else too that's gonna come up, but this is ours. That's why I like that song. It's only like a little over a minute and a half, so I mean the fact that it comes in and out very quickly is awesome. Pipe Bomb on Lansdowne, it's hard to talk about this one now after post the Boston bombing, even though it's not about an actual fucking bomb going off. It's essentially their version of talking shit to people that listen to shitty music. That is what, if you read the lyrics, that is exactly what this is. In fact, one of my favorite lines from here, I think it's in the third stanza. Let's say this: there's new room for dancing in your precious floors because you've got to save up the space for the jocks and whores. You say our shows are violent thugs, but we're not the ones on designer drugs. That's a fucking dig on pop music, if there ever was one. It's a dig on all of your like really popular people that try to have the polished music of that era. Don't forget, this is kind of like the Christina Aguilera, Britney Spears, NSYNC, Backstreet Boys era, where everything is
Yeah, TRL
polished and
Live.
clean, and it's okay for the young kids to listen to the fact these people are talking about banging and doing all these horrible things, but because it's not aggressive, it's okay. And that's kind of where that's a dig at. That's why I fucking love that song. Perfect Stranger is good. I mean, it's okay. I'm not gonna say it's great, but it's good. The one that really sticks out to me after that, though, is 10 years of Service. That is very much working man's punk. That is essentially about being on, protesting your worker, your employers, and getting fucked over because of it. That is entirely what that song is about. It's essentially like, hey, we grew up with this different time period, and I spent 10 years of service working my ass off for you, and you're telling me to go fuck myself. That's kind of where that hits. It's almost from like a factory worker's perspective more than anything else. That's kind of why the album speaks a lot to me. It is one of the longer tracks on this album, but it does kind of hit there. It's a little slowed down. Upstarts Broken Hearts is good. Devil's Brigade is really good. That one comes out and it punches hard. The next one that always sticks out to me, though, is Curse of a Fallen Soul. And the reason this is important, again, it slows it down. This is a 3-minute song. This is a song about losing your friends. This is almost, I call it the growing up song, because at the time, we think about the age I was when this came out. I wasn't thinking about losing any of my friends. Nothing seriously bad ever happened in high school. I mean, this is like Columbine happened earlier that year, but that was the first time any of us ever heard something horrible like that happening. So it's almost like everyone had this like innocent feel to them, and then you listen to the song and it's about, oh, going to another funeral again, another goodbyes you're ready to make. And what I love about it is a lot of people think it's blatantly Irish. I think it's blatantly fucking pirate. Because when they get down to the when they get down to the chorus, how is it? So may we round, I'm trying to go off memory on this. Round beyond the corpse of a dead man with a toast that tells of the ones you never shared. Says we dance in the grave of the misbehaved, raise your glass and sing your praise to the fallen soul. The way it's done, though, it almost sounds like I get pirate vibes more than anything else. Like stereotypical pirate vibes is what it reminds me of, at least on that. But it does feel like instead of being sad your friends are gone, it's more of like, hey, you're celebrating the fact they're alive, and you're celebrating their life rather than their death. And if you've never been to an Irish wake, that is exactly what the fuck it's like. It's, yay, people are going to be crying, you're going to have that, but it's less about being sad, more about the fact that, hey, this person's moved on, they're in a much better place right now. You should be celebrating life and celebrating what they were and what they had. And the entire point, Curse of a Fallen Soul, the curse is you moved on. I mean, it should be pretty obvious at that point, but that's why it always kind of stuck out to me. Going down, the Fighting 69th, That is an old song that was written during the Civil War. There is a 69th Infantry Division that's based in New York. And the song originally was done by the Wolftones. I think that's what made it popular. At least that's the one I always heard. So it's kind of cool they threw that on here. But it's a good rendition of it. It's very nice. The next one that really sticks out to me is "Wheel of Misfortune." This is the other one it's the longest song on here. This one is essentially about getting screwed over over and over again, and you keep giving up to have to go back out, getting off your feet, going back and doing what you were doing before, making yourself better. It's before you go do something, understand you have a lot to lose. Understand you're doing it for the right reasons. That's really what it's about. And if you actually read through the lyrics, it's kind of obvious they kind of hint at that a lot. And this is where you kind of get more in that thoughtful punk rather than just, I'm an angry kid and I want to like anarchy this, anarchy that, and like destruction and fuck the police. It's more of like, hey, it's going to make you think now. Amazing Grace is good. This is probably the first time I'd ever heard Amazing Grace on bagpipes sped up. To this day and age, you might hear it and think, what the hell? It's not that big of a deal. Take yourself back to that time period of March of 1999 and tell me what else was out there, because there wasn't a whole lot. So it's a pretty good way. I would almost have ended the album there. The Gang's All Here, I'm kind of like you. It kind of doesn't feel like a punk song. It almost feels popish in a way. And it's interesting because the pacing slowed down a lot. But going back to everything else, this is where that bar punk comes from. This is essentially, you've dealt with all this shit your entire day, your family's taken care of, your job is secure, whatever. You're feeling down. Hey, you know what? The rest of us are too. Come have a fucking drink with us at the pub. That is what that song is about. And then, by the way, if you need help, we're gonna help you out. That is definitely that's to me, if I had to give any credence to what you said, Ben, about this being like a GI album, that's where that fits to me. That's where I'm like, yeah, that's definitely a military aspect to that. Even though I don't know that anyone else did any active duty service. I know that Mike did. This definitely feels like something Mike would have written, even though he didn't. So I in a way, even though the pacing is kind of low, I do think it's a good way to end the album out.
I agree with that. And I think that, like, the one thing that I will say in the Gang's All Here's defense is it does mirror Roll Call very well. For an opener and a closer, even though Roll Call is like super duper short and the Gang's All Here is super duper long. But it's like the gathering of the friends, then the party at the end of it. The only other thing I want to touch on is going back to Blood and Whiskey. I did look up the lyrics, and reading through the lyrics, it sounds more like it's a song about Rocky Marciano or some other Boston boxer than it does anything to do with the Easter Uprising. But that's just me, and maybe I don't know what I'm talking about.
So I've heard that. I've heard, like I said, I've heard a lot of things about it. They're not really open about what they wrote about it about. Boxing, for those, I mean, boxing is a rich tradition. A lot of cultures do it, but you always see it stereotype. Hey, Irish boxer doing this, and I don't know. It seems like the lyrics are supposed to be a little deeper than that. So that's kind of what always meant like to me when I'm reading through it. But you could be right. Maybe it's about Rocky and I'm wrong, and but I don't know where the whole 1916 thing came up at. The only I don't know where that came from. I think that person's probably smoking something they shouldn't be smoking, but hey, who am I to judge? It was their interpretation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It could be anything, but like, especially the shoeshine boy to champion, he'd fought and beaten many foes. His calling card was a kick to the groin or broken bottle to the bridge of the nose. That doesn't sound like a boxer, but just a street fighting dude. But then they talk about taking the ring, and the Boston Strong Boy loved to fight. On more than one occasion, a battle stopped to save an opponent's life. So I don't know. Anyway.
That's why I say to me it sounds more like the whole, hey, we came here, people thought we were violent, and we probably were at one point, but then we picked each other up after the fight was that's sort of like if you can read into this all day. And
Yeah, totally.
I'm sure if you could corner Al or Ken at a show and ask them, hey, what the hell were you guys writing this about? Because we had an argument on our podcast that like 10 people listened to and were kind of curious. I'm sure they would tell us. But that's always how I interpreted it. And of course, again, art being art. Unless there's a blatant, unless the artist says blatantly, no, this is exactly what it's meant to be. Art is always open to interpretation,
Yeah,
and
totally.
music is like that a lot too.
All right, well, I think it's time to grade it.
I do too. Ben, again, this is your first time listening to it, so I'm gonna let you go first.
So I think it's a really strong album, especially for a second album. There's a lot to like here. It's not my favorite. It's definitely, by them. But I'm going to come in and give it a B minus, because I do think that there's some really good stuff here. They're still kind of finding their identity. It's a little on the generic side because of that, but they are also doing stuff that nobody else really does. So it strikes a very interesting, like, middle ground between those two things.
So again, as usual, for those that have never listened to my podcast, our podcast here, I give bands two grades. And the reason I do that is because this is a punk podcast first and foremost, but I'm also someone that likes to view things from just a musical perspective as well. As a punk album, I think it did pretty damn good. I'm actually gonna give it an A as far as punk album goes, because it kind of checked all the boxes for me. What keeps it from getting an A plus for me is it could have been more aggressive. It could have been more in your face. I do think even though the ones I liked, they slowed it down a little bit, so it kind of hurt the pacing. But I still think that the place of anger and annoyance and all the other things taken from a negative perspective and put into music and put out there, as in, hey, I've got something to say and this is it. It's very much a punk album for me. So while it's not an A plus and it kind of teeters on A minus, I'm going to give it a little bit of push towards A because it does check those boxes. From a music perspective, I think they're on point. I would have given it an A. I'm going to give it a B plus instead. And the reason for that is this feels like Do or Die Part Two. And the reason I say that is because when you replace someone in a band, it can change things. When they replaced Mike, it didn't change it a ton, but it changed it enough to where they had to almost rediscover themselves and figure out what they were going to do from this point on. So I'm actually going to mirror kind of what you said there, Ben. I do think this is, if they had not replaced a singer, I think this would have been a little bit better than it was. But it is still, I still tell people, like, hey, what's your. If I had to listen to this band, what would you point me towards? The first three albums in a row in that order is usually what I tell people. Because even though this one, I don't think it's as good as the previous album, I think it's a lot better than some of the other things we've discussed on this podcast. Not all of them, but some of them. So there you go, A and B plus.
Right on, man. So, what are we doing next?
Next week, we're going to talk about the other technical American band on here, even though the singer is Irish, and we will get to that when we get there. But you know who this band is. If you didn't figure out by then, if you don't, it's probably the one that everyone knows, even if you don't listen to this kind of music.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And, you'll figure it out between now and then, I'm sure. All right, we'll catch you then. Thanks for listening to Static Rage.
Have a good night.